I've flown to Grand Cayman 9 times, bought 9 sets of new luggage, and hauled back a ton of stolen documents. I've driven to Nashville 4 times and flown 10. I've read so many bank records and illegal crap, I'm half blind. And when it's bedtime, I put on my little Dustbusters shirt and play maid for 6 hours. I got so many names, I've written them on my hand so I won't get confused. I've got another for you. This doesn't surprise me. What? Mary Alice. From now on, when you talk to Terrence, you're Mary Alice. Let me write that down. I don't like him. He's very rude on the phone. I've got great news for you. I can't wait. You can quit Dustbusters. I think I'll lie down and cry. Why? It's hopeless. I told you that a week ago. Houdini couldn't get files out of there, copy them, and sneak them back in without getting caught. Did you talk to Abanks? Mitch asked. Yes. Did he get the money? Yes, it was wired Friday. Is he ready? Said he was. Good. What about the forger? I'm meeting with him this afternoon. Who is he? An ex-con. He and Lomax were old pals. Eddie said he was the best documents man in the country. He'd better be. How much? $5,000. Cash, of course. New IDs, passports, driver's licenses, and visas. How long will it take him? I don't know. When do you need it? Mitch sat on the edge of the rented desk. He breathed deeply and tried to think, to calculate. As soon as possible. I thought I had a week, but now I don't know. Just get it as soon as possible. Can you drive to Nashville tonight? Oh, yes, I'd love to. I haven't been there in 2 days. I want a Sony camcorder with a tripod set up in the bedroom. Buy a case of tapes. And I want you to stay there by the phone for the next few days. Review the Bendini papers again. Work on your summaries.
You mean I have to stay there?
Yeah, why? I've ruptured 2 discs sleeping on that couch.
You rented it.
What about the passports?
What's the guy's name?
Doc somebody. I've got his number. Give it to me. Tell him I'll call in a day or so. How much money do you have?
I'm glad you asked. I started with $50,000, right? I've spent $10,000 on airfare, hotels, luggage, and rental cars. And I'm still spending. Now you want a video camera and fake IDs. I'd hate to lose money on this deal.
Mitch started for the door. How about another $50,000?
I'll take it.
He winked at her and closed the door, wondering if he would ever see her again. The cell was 8 by 8, with a toilet in a corner and a set of bunk beds. The top bunk was uninhabited and had been for a year. Ray lay on the bottom bunk with wires running from his ears. He spoke to himself in a very foreign language. Turkish. At that moment on that floor, it was safe to bet he was the only soul listening to Berlitz jabber in Turkish. There was quiet talk up and down the hall, but most lights were out. 11 o'clock, Tuesday night. The guard walked silently to his cell.
McDear, he said softly, secretly, through the bars.
Ray sat on the edge of the bed, under the bunk above, and stared at him. He removed the wires. Warden wants to see you. Sure, he thought. The warden's sitting at his desk at 11 p.m. waiting on me.
Where are we going?
It was an anxious question.
Put your shoes on and come on.
Ray glanced around the cell and took a quick inventory of his worldly possessions.
In 8 years, he had accumulated a black-and-white television, a large cassette player, 2 cardboard boxes full of tapes, and several dozen books. He made $3 a day working in the prison laundry, but after cigarettes, there had been little to spend on tangibles. These were his only assets. 8 years. The guard fitted a heavy key in the door and slid it open a few inches. He turned off the light. "Just follow me, and no cute stuff. I don't know who you are, mister, but you got some heavy-duty friends." Other keys fit other doors, and they were outside under the basketball hoop. "Stay behind me," the guard said. Ray's eyes darted around the dark compound. The wall loomed like a mountain in the distance, beyond the courtyard and walking area where he had paced 1,000 miles and smoked a ton of cigarettes. It was 16 feet tall in the daylight, but looked much larger at night. The guard towers were 50 yards apart and well-lit, and heavily armed. The guard was casual and unconcerned. Of course, he had a uniform and a gun. He moved confidently between 2 cinder-block buildings, telling Ray to follow and be cool. Ray tried to be cool. They stopped at the corner of a building, and the guard gazed at the wall 80 feet away. Floodlights made a routine sweep of the courtyard, and they backed into the darkness. "Why are we hiding?" Ray asked himself. "Are those guys up there with the guns on our side?" He would like to know before he made any dramatic moves. The guard pointed to the exact spot on the wall where James Earl Ray and his gang went over. A rather famous spot, studied and admired by most of the inmates at Brushy Mountain. Most of the white ones, anyway. "In about 5 minutes, they'll throw a ladder up there. The wire has already been cut on top. You'll find a heavy rope on the other side. Mind if I ask a few questions?" "Make it quick." "What about all these lights?" "They'll be diverted. You'll have total darkness." "And those guns up there?" "Don't worry. They'll look the other way."
"Damn it, are you sure?"
"Look, man, I've seen some inside jobs before, but this takes the cake. Warden Latimer himself planned this one. He's right up there." The guard pointed to the nearest tower.
"The warden?"
"Yep. Just so nothing'll go wrong." "Who's throwing up the ladder?"
"Couple of guards."
Ray wiped his forehead with his sleeve and breathed deeply. His mouth was dry and his knees were weak. The guard whispered, "There'll be a dude waiting for you. His name is Bud. White dude. He'll find you on the other side and just do what he says." The floodlights swept through again, then died.
"Get ready," the guard said.
Darkness settled in, followed by a dreadful silence. The wall was now black. From the nearest tower, a whistle blew 2 short signals. Ray knelt and watched. From behind the next building, he could see the silhouettes running to the wall. They grabbed at something in the grass, then hoisted it.
"Run, dude," the guard said. "Run!"
Ray sprinted with his head low. The homemade ladder was in place. The guards grabbed his arms and threw him to the first step. The ladder bounced as he scurried up the 2x4s. The top of the wall was 2 feet wide. A generous opening had been cut in the coiled barbed wire. He slid through without touching it. The rope was right where it was supposed to be, and he eased down the outside of the wall. 8 feet from pay dirt, he turned loose and jumped. He squatted and looked around. Still dark. The floodlights were on hold. The clearing stopped 100 feet away, and the dense woods began. "Over here," the voice said calmly. Ray started for it. Bud was waiting in the first cluster of black bushes. "Hurry, follow me." Ray followed him until the wall was out of sight. They stopped in a small clearing next to a dirt trail. He stuck out a hand. "I'm Bud Riley. Kind of fun, ain't it?"
"Unbelievable.
Ray McDear." Bud was a stocky man with a black beard and a black beret. He wore combat boots, jeans, and a camouflage jacket. No gun was in sight. He offered Ray a cigarette.
"Who are you with?" Ray asked.
"Nobody. I just do a little freelance work for the warden. They usually call me when somebody goes over the wall. Of course, this is a little different. Usually I bring my dogs. I thought we'd wait here for a minute until the sirens go off so you can hear. Wouldn't be right if you didn't get to hear them. I mean, they're sort of in your honor."
"That's okay. I've heard them before."
"Yeah, but it's different out here when they go off. It's a beautiful sound."
"Look, Bud, just listen, Ray. We got plenty of time. They won't chase you much."
"Much?"
"Yeah, they gotta make a big scene, wake everybody up, just like a real escape. But they ain't coming after you. I don't know what kind of pull you got, but it's something."
The sirens began screaming, and Ray jumped. Lights flashed across the black sky, and the faint voices of the tower guards were audible. "See what I mean?"
"Let's go," Ray said, and began walking.
"My truck's just up the road a piece. I brought you some clothes. Warden gave me your sizes. Hope you like them." Bud was out of breath when they reached the truck. Ray quickly changed into the olive duck heads and navy cotton work shirt.
"Very nice, Bud," he said.
"Just throw them prison clothes in the bushes." They drove the winding mountain trail for 2 miles, then turned onto blacktop. Bud listened to Conway Twitty and said nothing.
"Where are we going, Bud?" Ray finally asked.
"Well, the warden said he didn't care and really didn't want to know. Said it was up to you. I'd suggest we get to a big town where there's a bus station. After that, you're on your own."
"How far will you drive me?"
"I got all night, Ray. You name the town."
"I'd like to get some miles behind us before I start hanging around a bus station. How about in Knoxville?"
"Knoxville it is. Where are you going from there?"
"I don't know. I need to get out of the country."
"With your friends, that should be no problem. Be careful, though. By tomorrow, your picture will be hanging in every sheriff's office in 10 states.
3 cars with blue lights came blazing over the hill in front of them. Ray ducked onto the floorboard.
"Relax, Ray. They can't see you."
He watched them disappear through the rear window.
"What about roadblocks?"
"Look, Ray, ain't gonna be no roadblocks, okay? Trust me."
Bud stuck a hand in a pocket and threw a wad of cash on the seat. $500, hand-delivered by the warden. "You got some stout friends, buddy."
Chapter 34. Wednesday morning. Terry Ross climbed the stairs to the 4th floor of the Phoenix Park Hotel. He paused on the landing outside the hall door and caught his breath. Sweat beaded across his eyebrows. He removed the dark sunglasses and wiped his face with the sleeve of his overcoat. Nausea hit below the belt, and he leaned on the stair rail. He dropped his empty briefcase on the concrete and sat on the bottom step. His hands shook like severe palsy, and he wanted to cry. He clutched his stomach and tried not to vomit. The nausea passed, and he breathed again. "Be brave, man, be brave. There's 200,000 waiting down the hall. If you've got
guts, you can go in there and get it. You can walk out with it, but you must have courage. He breathed deeper and his hands settled down. Guts, man, guts. The weak knees wobbled, but he made it to the door. Down the hall, past the rooms. 8th door on the right. He held his breath and knocked. Seconds passed. He watched the dark hall through the dark glasses and could see nothing.
Yeah, a voice inside said, inches away.
It's Alfred.
Ridiculous name, he thought. Where'd it come from? The door cracked and a face appeared behind the little chain. The door closed, then opened wide. Alfred walked in.
Good morning, Alfred, Vinnie Cazzo said warmly. Would you like coffee?
I didn't come here for coffee, Alfred snapped. He placed the briefcase on the bed and stared at Cazzo.
You're always so nervous, Alfred. Why don't you relax? There's no way you can get caught.
Shut up, Cazzo. Where's the money?
Vinnie pointed to a leather handbag. He stopped, smiling. Talk to me, Alfred. The nausea hit again, but he kept his feet. He stared at them. His heart beat like pistons.
Okay. Your man, McDear, has been paid $1 million already. Another million is on the way. He's delivered one load of Bendini documents and claims to have 10,000 more.
A sharp pain hit his groin, and he sat on the edge of the bed. He removed his glasses.
Keep talking, Cazzo demanded.
McDear's talked to our people many times in the last 6 months. He'll testify at the trials, then hit the road as a protected witness. He and his wife.
Where are the other documents?
Damn it, I don't know. He won't tell. But they're ready to be delivered. I want my money, Cazzo.
Vinny threw the handbag on the bed. Alfred opened it and the briefcase. He attacked the stacks of bills, his hands shaking violently.
200,000? He asked desperately.
Vinny smiled.
That was the deal, Alfred. I got another job for you in a couple of weeks.
No way, Cazzo. I can't take any more of this.
He slammed the briefcase shut and ran to the door. He stopped and tried to calm himself.
What will you do with McDear? He asked, staring at the door.
What do you think, Alfred?
He bit his lip, clenched the briefcase, and walked from the room. Vinny smiled and locked the door. He pulled a card from his pocket and placed a call to the Chicago home of Mr. Lou Lazaroff. Terry Ross walked in panic down the hall. He could see little from behind the glasses. 7 doors down. Almost to the elevator, a huge hand reached from the darkness and pulled him into a room. The hand slapped him hard, and another fist landed in his stomach. Another fist to the nose. He was on the floor, dazed and bleeding. The briefcase was emptied on the bed. He was thrown into a chair, and the lights came on. 3 FBI agents, his comrades, glared at him. Director Voiles walked up to him, shaking his head in disbelief. The agent with the huge, efficient hands stood nearby, within striking distance. Another agent was counting money. Voiles leaned into his face.
You're a traitor, Ross. The lowest form of scum. I can't believe it.
Ross bit his lip and began sobbing.
Who is it? Voiles asked intently.
The crying was louder. No answer.
Voiles swung wildly and slapped Ross's left temple. He shrieked in pain. Who is it, Ross? Talk to me.
Vinnie Cazzo, he blurted between sobs.
I know it's Kazo. Damn it, I know that. But what did you tell him?
Tears ran from his eyes and blood poured from his nose. His body shook and gyrated pitifully. No answer. Voyles slapped him again and again. Tell me, you little son of a bitch. Tell me what Kazo wants. He slapped him again. Ross doubled over and dropped his head on his knees. The crying softened. $200,000, an agent said. Voyles dropped to one knee and almost whispered to Ross,
Is it McDear? Ross.
Please, oh please, tell me it's not McDear. Tell me, Terry, tell me it's not McDear. Terry stuck his elbows on his knees and stared at the floor. The blood dripped neatly into one little puddle on the carpet. Gut check, Terry. You don't get to keep your money. You're on the way to jail. You're a disgrace, Terry. You're a slimy little scuzzball of a chicken, and it's over. What could possibly be gained by keeping secrets? Gut check, Terry. Voyles was pleading softly. Sinners, won't you come? Please say it ain't McDear, Terry. Please tell me it ain't. Terry sat straight and wiped his eyes with his fingers. He breathed deeply, cleared his throat. He bit his lip, looked squarely at Voyles, and nodded. Devasher had no time for the elevator. He ran down the stairs to the fourth floor, to the corner, a power one, and barged into Locke's office. Half the partners were there. Locke, Lambert, Milligan, McKnight, Dunbar, Denton, Lawson, Banahan, Kruger, Welch, and Schatz. The other half had been summoned. A quiet panic filled the room. Devasher sat at the head of the conference table and they gathered around.
Okay, boys. It's not time to haul ass and head for Brazil. Not yet, anyway. We confirmed this morning that he has talked extensively to the Phibbies, that they have paid him $1 million cash, that they have promised $1 million, that he has certain documents that are believed to be fatal. This came straight from the FBI. Lazarov and a small army are flying into Memphis as we speak. It appears as though the damage has not been done. Yet, according to our source, a very high-ranking Phibby, McDear has over 10,000 documents in his possession, and he is ready to deliver. But he has only delivered a few so far. We think. Evidently, we have caught this thing in time. If we can prevent further damage, we should be okay. I say this even though they have some documents. Obviously, they don't have much, or they would have been here with search warrants.
Devasher was on stage. He enjoyed this immensely. He spoke with a patronizing smile and looked at each of the worried faces. Now, where is McDear? Milligan spoke.
In his office. I just talked to him. He suspects nothing.
Wonderful. He's scheduled to leave in 3 hours for Grand Cayman. Correct, Lambert?
That's correct. Around noon.
Boys, the plane will never make it. The pilot will land in New Orleans for an errand, then he'll take off for the island. About 30 minutes over the Gulf, the little blip will disappear from radar forever. Debris will scatter over a 30-square-mile area, and no bodies will ever be found. It's sad, but necessary.
The Lear? Asked Denton.
Yes, son, the Lear. We'll buy you another toy.
We're assuming a lot, Devasher, Locke said. We're assuming the documents already in their possession are harmless. 4 days ago, you thought McDear had copied some of Avery's secret files. What gives?
They studied the files in Chicago. Yeah, they're full of incriminating evidence, but not enough to move with. They couldn't get the first conviction. You guys know that damning materials are on the island, and, of course, in the basement. No one can penetrate the basement. We checked the files in the condo. Everything looked in order. Locke was not satisfied.
Then where did the 10,000 come from?
You're assuming he has 10,000. I rather doubt it. Keep in mind, he's trying to collect another $1 million before he takes off. He's probably lying to them and snooping around for more documents. If he had 10,000, why wouldn't the Phibbies have them by now?
Then what's to fear? Asked Lambert.
The fear is the unknown, Ollie. We don't know what he's got, except that he's got $1 million. He's no dummy, and he might just stumble across something if left alone. We cannot allow that to happen. Lazarov, you see, said to blow his ass out of the air. Quote, unquote. There's no way a rookie associate could find and copy that many incriminating records, Kruger said boldly, and looked around the group for approval. Several nodded at him with intense frowns.
Why is Lazarov coming? Asked Dunbar, the real estate man. He said Lazarov as if Charles Manson was coming to dinner.
That's a stupid question, DeVasher snapped and looked around for the idiot. First, we've got to take care of McDear and hope the damage is minimal. Then we'll take a long look at this unit and make whatever changes are necessary.
Locke stood and glared at Oliver Lambert.
Make sure McDear's on that plane.
Terence, Acklin, and Laney sat in stunned silence and listened to the speakerphone on the desk. It was Voiles in Washington explaining exactly what had happened. He would leave for Memphis within the hour. He was almost desperate.
You gotta bring him in, Terence.
And quick. Kazo doesn't know that we know about Terry Ross, but Ross told him McDear was on the verge of delivering the records. They could take him out at any time. You've got to get him. Now. Do you know where he is?
He's at the office, Terence said.
Okay. Fine. Bring him in.
I'll be there in 2 hours. I want to talk to him. Goodbye.
Terence punched the phone, then dialed the number.
Who are you calling? Acklin asked.
Bendini, Lambert, and Locke, attorneys at law.
Are you crazy, Wayne? Laney asked.
Just listen.
The receptionist answered the phone.
Mitch McDear, please, Terence said.
One moment, please, she said.
Then the secretary.
Mr. McDear's office?
I need to speak to Mitchell McDear.
I'm sorry, sir, he's in a meeting.
Listen, young lady, this is Judge Henry Hugo, and he was supposed to be in my courtroom 15 minutes ago. We're waiting for him. It's an emergency.
Well, I see nothing on his calendar for this morning.
Do you schedule his appointments?
Well, yes, sir.
Then it's your fault. Now get him on the phone.
Nina ran across the hall and into his office.
Mitch, there's a Judge Hugo on the phone. Says you're supposed to be in court right now. You'd better talk to him.
Mitch jumped to his feet and grabbed the phone. He was pale.
Yes, he said.
Mr. McDear, Terence said.
Judge Hugo, you're late for my court. Get over here.
Yes, Judge.
He grabbed his coat and briefcase and frowned at Nina.
I'm sorry, she said. It's not on your calendar.
Mitch raced down the hall, down the stairs, past the receptionist and out the front door. He ran north on Front Street to Union and darted through the lobby of the Cotton Exchange building. On Union, he turned east and ran toward the Mid-America Mall.
The sight of a well-dressed young man with a briefcase running like a scared dog may be a common sight in some cities, but not in Memphis. People noticed. He hid behind a fruit stand and caught his breath. He saw no one running behind him. He ate an apple. If it came to a foot race, he hoped Two-Ton Tony was chasing him. He had never been particularly impressed with Wayne Terrence. The Korean shoe store was a fiasco. The chicken place on Grand Cayman was equally dumb. His notebook on the Moraltos would bore a Cub Scout. But his idea about a Mayday code, a don't ask questions, just run for your life alert, was a brilliant idea. For a month, Mitch knew if Judge Hugo called, he had to hit the door on a dead run. Something bad had gone wrong, and the boys on the fifth floor were moving in. Where was Abby? He thought. A few pedestrians walked in pairs along Union. He wanted a crowded sidewalk, but there was none. He stared at the corner of Front and Union and saw nothing suspicious. Two blocks east, he casually entered the lobby of the Peabody and looked for a phone. On the mezzanine overlooking the lobby, he found a neglected one in a short hallway near the men's room. He dialed the Memphis office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. "Wayne Terrence, please. It's an emergency. This is Mitch McDear." Terrence was on the phone in seconds. "Mitch, where are you?" "Okay, Terrence, what's going on?" "Where are you?" "I'm out of the building, Judge Hugo. I'm safe for now. What's happened?" "Mitch, you've got to come in." "I don't have to do a damn thing, Terrence. And I won't until you talk to me." "Well, we've had a slight problem. There's been a small leak."
"You need
leak?
Terrence,
did you say leak? There's no such thing as a small leak. Talk to me, Terrence, before I hang up this phone and disappear."
"You're tracing this call, aren't you, Terrence?"
"I'm hanging up." "No! Listen, Mitch, they know. They know we've been talking, and they know about the money and the files."
There was a long pause. "A small leak, Terrence. Sounds like the dam burst. Tell me about this leak, and quick." "God, this hurts. Mitch, I want you to know how much this hurts. Voiles is devastated. One of our senior men sold the information. We caught him this morning at a hotel in Washington. They paid him $200,000 for the story on you. We're in shock, Mitch." "Oh, I'm touched. I'm truly concerned over your shock and pain, Terrence. I guess now you want me to run down there to your office so we can all sit around and console each other."
"Voiles will be there by noon, Mitch. He's flying in with his top people. He wants to meet with you. We'll get you out of town."
"Right. You want me to rush into your arms for protection. You're an idiot, Terrence. Voiles is an idiot. You're all idiots.
And I'm a fool for trusting you. Are you tracing this call, Terrence?"
"No."
"You're lying." "I'm hanging up, Terrence. Sit tight, and I'll call you in 30 minutes from another phone."
"No, Mitch, listen. You're dead if you don't come in."
"Goodbye, Wayne. Sit by the phone." Mitch dropped the receiver and looked around. He walked to a marble column and peeked at the lobby below. The ducks were swimming around the fountain. The bar was deserted. A table was surrounded with rich old ladies sipping their tea and gossiping. A solitary guest was registering. Suddenly the Nordic stepped from behind a potted tree and stared at him. "Up there," he yelled across the lobby to an accomplice. They watched him intently and glanced at the stairway under him. The bartender looked up at Mitch, then at the Nordic and his friend. The old ladies stared in silence.
"Call the police,"
Mitch yelled as he backed away from the railing. Both men sprang across the lobby and hit the stairs.
Mitch waited 5 seconds and returned to the railing. The bartender had not moved. The ladies were frozen. There were heavy noises on the stairs. Mitch sat on the railing, dropped his briefcase, swung his legs over, paused, then jumped 20 feet onto the carpet of the lobby. He fell like a rock, but landed squarely on both feet. Pain shot through his ankles and hips. The football knee buckled but did not collapse. Behind him, next to the elevators, was a small haberdashery with windows full of ties and Ralph Lauren's latest. He limped into it. A kid of no more than 19 waited eagerly behind the counter. There were no customers. An outside door opened onto Union. "Is that door locked?" Mitch asked calmly. "Yes, sir." "You want to make $1,000 cash? Nothing illegal." Mitch quickly peeled off 10 $100 bills and threw them on the counter.
Sure, I guess.
Nothing illegal, okay? I swear, I wouldn't get you in trouble. Unlock that door, and when two men come running in here in about 20 seconds, tell them I ran through that door and jumped in a cab. The kid smiled even brighter and raked up the money. Sure, no problem. Where's the dressing room? Yes, sir, over there, next to the closet. Unlock the door, Mitch said as he slid into the dressing room and sat down. He rubbed his knees and ankles. The clerk was straightening ties when the Nordic and his partner ran through the door from the lobby. Good morning, he said cheerfully. Did you see a man running through here, medium build, dark gray suit, red tie?
Yes, sir. He just ran through there, through that door, and jumped in a cab.
A cab. Damn! The door opened and closed, and the store was silent. The kid walked to a shoe rack near the closet. They're gone, sir. Mitch was rubbing his knees. Good. Go to the door and watch for 2 minutes. Let me know if you see them. 2 minutes later, he was back. They're gone. Mitch kept his seat and smiled at the door. Great. I want one of those Kelly Green sport coats, 44 long, and a pair of white buckskins, 10D. Bring them here, would you? And keep watching. Yes, sir. He whistled around the store as he collected the coat and shoes, then slid them under the door. Mitch yanked off his tie and changed quickly. He sat down. How much do I owe you? Mitch asked from the room. Well, let's see. How about 500? Fine. Call me a cab and let me know when it's outside. Terence walked 3 miles around his desk. The call was traced to the Peabody, but Laney arrived too late. He was back now, sitting nervously with Acklin. 40 minutes after the first call, the secretary's voice blasted through the intercom. Mr. Terence, it's McDear. Terence lunged at the phone. Where are you? In town, but not for long. Look, Mitch, you won't last 2 days on your own. They'll fly in enough thugs to start another war. You've got to let us help you.
I don't know, Terence. For some strange reason, I just don't trust you boys right now.
I can't imagine why. Just a bad feeling. Please, Mitch, don't make this mistake. I guess you want me to believe you boys can protect me for the rest of my life.
Sort of funny, isn't it, Terence? I cut a deal with the FBI, and I almost get gunned in my own office.
That's real protection. Terence breathed deeply into the phone. There was a long pause. What about the documents? We've paid you $1 million for them.
You're cracking up, Terence. You paid me $1 million for my clean files.
You got them, and I got the $1 million.
Of course, that was just part of the deal. Protection was also a part of it.
Give us the damn files, Mitch. They're hidden somewhere close to us. You told me that. Take off if you want to, but leave the files.
won't work, Terrence. Right now, I can disappear, and the Moraltos may or may not come after me. If you don't get the files, you don't get the indictments. If the Moraltos don't get indicted, maybe, if I'm lucky, one day they'll just forget about me. I gave them a real scare, but no permanent damage. Hell, they may even hire me back one of these days. You don't really believe that. They'll chase you until they find you. If we don't get the records, we'll be chasing too. It's that simple, Mitch. Then I'll put my money on the Moraltos. If you guys find me first, there'll be a leak. Just a small one. You're out of your mind, Mitch. If you think you can take your million and ride into the sunset, you're a fool. They'll have goons on camels riding the deserts looking for you. Don't do it, Mitch. Goodbye, Wayne. Ray sends his regards. The line was dead. Terrence grabbed the phone and threw it against the wall. Mitch glanced at the clock on the airport wall. He punched in another call. Tammy answered. Hello, sweetheart. Hate to wake you. Don't worry. The couch kept me awake. What's up? Major trouble. Get a pencil and listen very carefully. I don't have a second to waste. I'm running, and they're right behind me. Fire away. First, call Abby at her parents. Tell her to drop everything and get out of town. She doesn't have time to kiss her mother goodbye or to pack any clothes. Tell her to drop the phone, get in her car, and drive away. And don't look back. She takes Interstate 64 to Huntington, West Virginia, and goes to the airport. She flies from Huntington to Mobile. In Mobile, she rents a car and drives east on Interstate 10 to Gulf Shores, then east on Highway 182 to Perdido Beach. She checks in at the Perdido Beach Hilton under the name of Rachel James, and she waits. Got that?
Yeah.
Second, I need you to get on a plane and fly to Memphis. I called Doc, and the passports, etc. are not ready. I cussed him, but to no avail. He promised to work all night and have them ready in the morning. I will not be here in the morning, but you will. Get the documents.
Yes, sir.
Third, get on a plane and get back to the apartment in Nashville. Sit by the phone. Do not, under any circumstances, leave the phone.
Got it?
Fourth, call ABAX.
Okay.
What are your travel plans? I'm coming to Nashville, but I'm not sure when I'll be there. I gotta go. Listen, Tammy, tell Abby she could be dead within the hour if she doesn't run. So run, damn it, run.
Okay, boss.
He walked quickly to gate 22 and boarded the 1004 Delta flight to Cincinnati. He clutched a magazine full of one-way tickets, all bought with MasterCard. One to Tulsa on American Flight 233, leaving at 1014 and purchased in the name of Mitch McDear. One to Chicago on Northwest Flight 861, leaving at 1015 and purchased in the name of Mitchell McDear. One to Dallas on United Flight 562, leaving at 1030 and purchased in the name of Mitchell McDear. And one to Atlanta on Delta Flight 790, leaving at 1110 and purchased in the name of Mitchell McDear. The ticket to Cincinnati had been bought with cash in the name of Sam Fortune. Lazarov entered the power office on the fourth floor, and every head bowed. Devasher faced him like a scared, whipped child. The partners studied their shoelaces and held their bowels.
"We can't find him," Devasher said.
Lazarov was not one to scream and cuss. He took great pride in being cool under pressure.
"You mean he just got up and walked out of here?" he asked coolly.
There was no answer. None was needed.
"All right, Devasher. This is the plan. Send every man you've got to the airport. Check with every airline. Where's his car?
In the parking lot.
That's great. He left here on foot. He walked out of your little fortress on foot. Joey'll love this. Check with every rental car company. Now, how many honorable partners do we have here?
16 present.
Divide them up in pairs and send them to the airports in Miami, New Orleans, Houston, Atlanta, Chicago, L.A., San Francisco, and New York. Roam the concourses of these airports. Live in these airports. Eat in these airports. Watch the international flights in these airports. We'll send reinforcements tomorrow. You honorable esquires know him well, so go find him. It's a long shot, but what have we got to lose? It'll keep you counselors busy. And I hate to tell you, boys, but these hours are not billable. Now, where's his wife?
Danesboro, Kentucky, at her parents'.
Go get her. Don't hurt her, just bring her in.
Do we start shredding? Devasher asked.
We'll wait 24 hours. Send someone to Grand Cayman and destroy those records.
Now hurry, Devasher. The power office emptied.
Voiles stomped around Terence's desk and barked commands. A dozen lieutenants scribbled as he yelled.
Cover the airport. Check every airline. Notify every office in every major city. Contact customs. Do we have a picture of him?
We can't find one, sir.
Find one and find it quick. It needs to be in every FBI and customs office by tonight. He's on the run, son of a bitch!
Chapter 35. The bus left Birmingham shortly before 2 p.m. Wednesday. Ray sat in the rear and studied every person who climbed in and found a seat. He looked sporty. He had taken a cab to a mall in Birmingham and in 30 minutes had purchased a new pair of faded Levi's, a plaid short-sleeved golf shirt, and a pair of red and white Reeboks. He had also eaten a pizza and received a severe marine-style haircut. He wore aviator sunshades and an auburn cap. A short, fat, dark-skinned lady sat next to him. He smiled at her.
¿De dónde es usted? He asked.
Where are you from? Her face broke into unrestrained delight. A wide smile revealed few teeth.
Mexico, she said proudly. ¿Habla español? She asked eagerly.
Sí. For 2 hours they jabbered in Spanish as the bus rolled along to Montgomery. She had to repeat occasionally, but he surprised himself. He was 8 years out of practice and a little rusty. Behind the bus, Special Agents Jenkins and Jones followed in a Dodge Aries. Jenkins drove while Jones slept. The trip had become boring 10 minutes out of Knoxville. Just routine surveillance, they were told. If you lose him, no big deal. But try not to lose him.
The flight from Huntington to Atlanta was 2 hours away, and Abby sat in a secluded corner of a dark lounge, watching. Just watching. In the chair next to her was a carry-on bag. Contrary to her urgent instructions, she had packed a toothbrush, makeup, and a few clothes. She had also written a note to her parents, giving a brief story about how she had to run to Memphis, needed to see Mitch. Everything's fine, don't worry. Hugs and kisses. Love, Abby. She ignored the coffee and watched the arriving and departing. She did not know if he was dead or alive. Tammy said he was scared but very much in control, as always. She said he was flying to Nashville, and she, Tammy, was flying to Memphis. Confusing, but she was certain he knew what he was doing.
Get to Perdido Beach and wait. Abby had never heard of Perdido Beach, but she was certain he'd never been there either. The lounge was nerve-wracking. Every 10 minutes, a drunk businessman would venture over and throw something suggestive at her. Get lost, she said a dozen times. After 2 hours, they boarded. Abby was stuck in the aisle seat. She buckled her belt and relaxed. And then she saw her. She was a striking blonde with high cheekbones and a firm jaw that was almost unfeminine, yet strong and attractive. Abby had seen the partial face before, partial because the eyes were covered as before. She looked at Abby and glanced away as she passed and went to her seat somewhere in the rear. The shipwreck bar. The blonde in the shipwreck bar. The blonde who was eavesdropping on her and Mitch and Abax. They had found her. And if they had found her, where was her husband? What had they done to him? She thought of the 2-hour drive from Danesboro to Huntington through the winding mountain roads. She had driven like a maniac. They could not have followed her. They taxied from the terminal and minutes later lifted off for Atlanta. For a second time in 3 weeks, Abby watched dusk from the inside of a 727 at the airport in Atlanta. She and the blonde. They were on the ground for 30 minutes and then left for Mobile. From Cincinnati, Mitch flew to Nashville. He arrived at 6 p.m. Wednesday, long after the banks had closed. He found a U-Haul truck rental place in the phone book and flagged a cab. He rented one of the smaller models, a 16-footer. He paid cash but was forced to use his driver's license and a credit card for a deposit. If DeVasher could track him to a U-Haul place in Nashville, so be it. He bought 20 cardboard packing boxes and left for the apartment. He had not eaten since Tuesday night, but he was in luck. Tammy had left a bag of microwave popcorn and 2 beers. He ate like a pig. At 8, he made his first call to the Perdido Beach Hilton. He asked for Lee Stevens. He had not arrived, she said. He stretched out on the den floor and thought of 100 things that could happen to Abby. She could be dead in Kentucky, and he wouldn't know. He couldn't call. The couch had not been folded, and the cheap sheets hung off the end and fell to the floor. Tammy was not much for housework. He looked at the small, temporary bed and thought of Abby. Only 5 nights ago, they had tried to kill each other on the bed. Hopefully, she was on the plane, alone. In the bedroom, he sat on the unopened Sony box and marveled at the room full of documents. Across the carpet, she had built perfect columns of paper, all painstakingly divided into Cayman Banks and Cayman Companies. On top of each stack was a yellow legal pad with the company name followed by pages of dates and entries. And names. Even Terrence could follow the paper trail. A grand jury would eat it up. The U.S. attorney would call press conferences. And the trial juries would convict and convict and convict.
Special Agent Jenkins yawned into the telephone receiver and punched the numbers to the Memphis office. He had not slept in 24 hours. Jones was snoring in the car.
FBI, a male voice said.
Yeah, who's there? Jenkins asked. Just a routine check-in.
Acklin?
Hey, Rick, this is Jenkins.
Jenkins? Where have you been? Hold on.
Jenkins quit yawning and looked around the bus terminal. An angry voice yelled into the earpiece.
Jenkins, where are you?
It was Wayne Terrence.
We're at the bus station in Mobile. We've lost him.
You what?
How could you lose him?
Jenkins was suddenly alert and leaning into the phone.
Wait a minute, Wayne.
Our instructions were to follow him for 8 hours to see where he went. Routine, you said. I can't believe you lost him.
Wayne, we weren't told to follow him for the rest of his life.
8 hours, Wayne. We've followed for 20 hours and he's disappeared. What's the big deal?
Why haven't you called in before now?
We called in twice, in Birmingham and Montgomery. Line was busy both times. What's going on, Wayne?
Just a minute.
Jenkins grabbed the phone tighter and waited. Another voice.
Hello, Jenkins.
Yes? Director Voyles here.
What the hell happened?
Jenkins held his breath and looked wildly around the terminal.
Sir, we lost him. We followed him for 20 hours, and when he got off the bus here in Mobile, we lost him in the crowd.
That's great, son. How long ago?
20 minutes.
All right, listen. We desperately need to find him. His brother has taken our money and disappeared. Call the locals there in Mobile. Tell them who you are and that an escaped murderer is on the loose in town. They've probably got Ray McDear's name and picture stuck to the walls. His mother lives in Panama City Beach, so alert every local between there and Mobile. I'm sending in our troops.
Okay. I'm sorry, sir. We weren't told to trail him forever.
We'll discuss it later.
At 10, Mitch called the Perdido Beach Hilton for the second time. He asked for Rachel James. No arrival. He asked for Lee Stevens.
One moment, she said.
Mitch sat on the floor and waited intently. The line to the room was ringing. After a dozen rings, someone picked up.
Yeah.
It was quick.
Lee? Mitch asked.
A pause.
Yeah.
This is Mitch. Congratulations.
Ray fell on the bed and closed his eyes.
It was so easy, Mitch. How'd you do it?
I'll tell you when we have time. Right now, there are a bunch of folks trying to kill me. And Abby. We're on the run.
Who, Mitch?
It would take 10 hours to tell the first chapter. We'll do it later. Write this number down. 615-889-4380.
That's not Memphis.
No, it's Nashville. I'm in an apartment that's serving as mission control. Memorize that number. If I'm not here, the phone will be answered by a girl named Tammy.
Tammy?
It's a long story. Just do as I say. Sometime tonight, Abby will check in there under the name of Rachel James. She'll be in a rented car.
She's coming here.
Just listen, Ray. The cannibals are chasing us, but we're a step ahead of them.
Ahead of who?
The Mafia. And the FBI.
Is that all?
Probably. Now listen to me. There is a slight chance Abby is being followed. You've got to find her, watch her, and make damn sure no one is behind her.
And if they are?
Call me and we'll talk about it.
No problem.
Don't use the phone except to call this number, and we can't talk much.
I've got a bunch of questions, little brother.
And I've got the answers, but not now. Take care of my wife and call me when she gets there.
Will do.
And Mitch.
Thanks.
Adios.
An hour later, Abby turned off Highway 182 onto the winding driveway to the Hilton. She parked the four-door Cutlass with Alabama tags and walked nervously under the sprawling veranda to the front doors. She stopped for a second, looked behind her at the driveway, and went inside. 2 minutes later, a yellow cab from Mobile stopped under the veranda behind the shuttle vans. Ray watched the cab. A woman was in the back seat, leaning forward and talking to the driver. They waited a minute. She pulled money from her purse and paid him. She got out and waited until the cab drove away. The woman was a blonde, and that was the first thing he noticed. Very shapely, with tight black corduroy pants, and black
sunglasses, which seemed odd to him because it was pushing midnight. She walked suspiciously to the front doors, waited a minute, then went in. He watched her carefully. He moved toward the lobby. The blonde approached the only clerk behind